Hello, I'm Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 678, interview with Paul Fitzgerald and Liz Gould. This program is being recorded on July 5th of the year 2009, and it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring to our airwaves Paul Fitzgerald and Liz Gould, the author of the consummately important recent book, Afghanistan's Untold Story, published in soft cover by City Lights Books. Paul and Liz, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
In describing books, one sometimes sees a munitions metaphor used. You'll see references to a book as a literary bombshell or a blockbuster of a book. Usually those munitions metaphors are applied more commonly to film or other events. I'd like to construct a munitions metaphor for your book that I think is absolutely appropriate. There's been a devastating type of aerial munition that has come into use in the last several decades called a cluster bomb. It's an aerial drop munition in which, after the original bomb explodes, it scatters little bomblets all over the ground, which then go off over a long period of time and can really be quite devastating if used when the actual weapon is used. And I think in many ways your book could be described as a literary cluster bomb, because in addition to the overall detonation, the overall impact of the book itself, there are all sorts of little bomblets that are scattered throughout the book and are inextricably linked with the actual subject material. And before we get into the book itself, I'd like to give the audience a short taste of the actual text and of the kind of material that is available here to their literary and intellectual palate. On 259, in talking about some of the operators on the ground working on their own, and also a subject I'd perhaps like to come back to at greater length in a future interview, namely the paramount role of the narcotics traffic in the Afghan imbroglio, you write on page 259, a wonderful little bomblet here. Author and activist Rob Schultes, who'd covered the Mujahideen for Time magazine during the war against the Russians, continued to hold very strong opinions on how the Afghan heroin problem went global. Quote, "My theory is that a lot of the policy decisions that were made here that were so inexplicable were produced by corruption on a local level by CIA station chiefs and lower. I actually know some things about that. Somebody I know in Washington told me, quote, this is all I'm going to say to you. The planes flew in full and they flew out full. That's all I'm going to say. You know, a lot of fortunes have been made in Langley. I think a lot of the dirty things that went on at that level and a lot of what's happening today is being done by friends of those people covering for them at this point because they don't want to see old Colonel Klutz or whomever going to prison. And I think the stuff's probably still going on because of that." Schultes mints no words about CIA culpability for 9/11 and the hideous betrayal of both American and Afghan lives being covered up by the blanket secrecy imposed by the War on Terror. "I worked for the agency briefly on my way out of college. My father was a lifer at the agency. Now I find them morally repulsive. The majority of them should be in prison who were in charge of the Afghan-Pakistani operation. They're directly responsible for 9/11 happening. They were getting paid a lot of money to make sure that wasn't going to happen, and they didn't do anything." That is the sort of material with which your book is filled. Those are the sort of little bomblets that are contained in this cluster bomb of a book. And what I'd like to do would be to give the audience some background on how all of this came to be. How did the planes come to be flying in full and coming out full? And beyond that, how did we find ourselves entangled in this horrendous, bloody, and seemingly inextricable imbroglio?
Well, you know, what we wanted to do, Dave, is to give people the feel of what it's like on the ground without that kind of middleman thing that you get from a news editor. We had experienced that ourselves, and the first time that we went there in 1981 for CBS News, we saw a story that was very difficult, very different than the kind of us-against-them Cold War rehash that we were seeing on the evening news, that all the major news operations were maintaining. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to cut through the BS and get to the point of what exactly was going on there. And over the next few years, we were able to do that. We did that in 1981. We brought our stuff back to CBS News, plop the tapes on the desk, and the guy looks at us and says, there's not really very much here. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we're looking for Russians. And you know, I said, well, that's not necessarily the story. And to which he replied, well, I didn't read that in the New York Times. So that was the way, that was the attitude that we faced. And then again in 1983, we brought, in order to get around that kind of blockade, we brought Roger Fisher from the Harvard Negotiation Project back with us to Afghanistan to talk with the Russians to see what it would take to get them to go home. Now, President Jimmy Carter had said specifically that it was the greatest threat, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was the greatest threat to peace since World War II. Well, that being the case, if we can get them to go home, then we'll take away a very, very serious threat to our existence. And we discovered that the U.S. media and the United States government had absolutely no interest in getting the Soviets to go home. They were busy holding them down there with a covert campaign, which everyone knew outside of the United States was going on. It was being published, stories about it were being published in Canada and in Europe. The Soviets certainly knew there was a covert campaign going on. The Pakistanis, Afghans, Iranians, Indians, et cetera, the American public didn't know it. And so when you get an event like 9/11, or you get this massive drug dealing that was supporting the Mujahideen that grew up in the 1980s, there have always been drugs in that part of the world, but they were contained. They were really under a great deal of organized control with the help of the United States and the Soviet Union with these various governments. But all of these things have been so entirely corrupted at this point that there is no way to even contain it.
Well, you know, in truth, though, when you pull back to when we really originally noticed Afghanistan, it actually was at a time, 1979 was when President Jimmy Carter came to office. Basically, he was really coming in with the idea that we were going to reduce arms spending. And that was a really big deal at the time. There was the negotiation of the SALT Treaty. That was attempting to be negotiated, and it was very important at the time. This was the post-Vietnam War era. There was a revelation going on inside the Beltway that the idea that you could really just use military endlessly and solve any kind of problem anywhere in the world was really being questioned. So we were really looking at that point to a new kind of really competition with the Soviets. It was going to go from military competition much more into civilian competition. And what happened was interesting because we were working on the documentary about this issue. We were interviewing people like John Galbraith and Paul Warnke, who negotiated the treaty. Galbraith made it very clear, in fact, that at that moment in time, we really needed to reinvest in the civilian economy, that we really had reached the point of the diminishing returns. When you spend so much in the military, you actually undermine your civilian economy. So this was all part of thinking, well, what happened on December 27, 1979 seemed miraculous to us. All of a sudden, the Soviets crossed the border to a neighboring country that was not considered even a part of America's interest at that point. It was not considered strategic to the United States. And it was suddenly a reason to literally turn back the clock on negotiation on any kind of relationship with the Soviets that would reduce arms spending. It seemed within a matter of days, there was the discussion had shifted from reduced arms spending and what we were going to do with that for the civilian economy. And suddenly it was how much were we going to increase the defense budget? And that really did get our attention right up front. We just wondered what could have happened. How did this happen? So the sense that some decision had been made long before the Soviets crossed the border, that feeling, that impression was very obvious. And so as we began to notice this story, the Soviets actually what happened was the Western media had gotten kicked out of Afghanistan within weeks after the Soviet invasion. And then there was a blackout, and that became our opportunity because the stories at that point were so fantastic about what was happening. It seemed that you know it needed a new set of eyes to look at it. So that's really what got us started on the whole process. And of course, in 30 years, what we've discovered is that there was a huge backstory that goes back. You know, really, it goes back in specific. specifically into for Afghanistan, you really have to pull the clock back into almost post-World War II. You have to pull the clock back, you know, when the beginning of the origins of the national security state starting, and the idea of an endless competition, a military competition with the Soviets, it was really started at that point.
You really have to look back to the British Empire. The United States inherited the obligations of the British Empire in 1947 when they partitioned India. And the center of the British Empire's global efforts centered around Afghanistan. Now, what's so very interesting about that is that the United States inherited that responsibility in 1947, but it had so many other areas of interest and influence around the world that it never really paid very much attention to it. In fact, the bureaucracy in Washington is so stolid that it never even, you know, the old expression we have around here, dawn breaks over Marblehead. Well, you know, it never broke over Washington until 1953 that the United States might have some kind of interests in Afghanistan. That was when their prime minister, Mohammed Daoud, who was the cousin of the King Zahir Shah, decided after having asked the United States for financial and military assistance to get some basic things done in Afghanistan, and after being rebuffed by the Dulles brothers, the Secretary of State and CIA director in the 1950s under the Eisenhower administration, he turned towards the Soviet Union and Nikita Khrushchev, and of course they were very happy to supply him with the 100-bed hospital, the 50-city buses, the concrete factories so that they could pave the roads, et cetera, that they had been asking the United States to offer them. So that was the beginning. At that point, Afghanistan finally got America's attention, but it was still and remains to this day the center of this global focus on pressing into Eurasia, which was defined by people like Mackinder, the geographer Mackinder, British geographer, late 19th century, and carried into the Nazi regime with Karl Haushofer as an example.
One of the concepts that you introduced to your readers, and something that I've been talking about for years in conjunction with the wars on the Eurasian landmass in which we're currently enmeshed, and that is the concept of the Earth Island or World Island. I wonder if you could encapsulate that for us.
That whole idea came about, we refer to it as mystical imperialism. The whole idea that the British Empire, when they started out in essentially 1600, Queen Elizabeth I chartered the East India Company, which went into, bit by bit, into India, established trading posts in various parts of India, and over a period of time became a de facto ruler. It was kind of, this was the nature of combining God's will of Christianizing the world with the corporate structure. Okay, in fact, the United States, Plymouth Plantation and the plantation in Virginia, were started as businesses. They weren't started as colonies that these individuals intended to populate. They were started as corporations, essentially, for the objective of creating this kind of new earth. The New Atlantis, I believe, is what they referred to it as. You had Bacon and Milton talking about some of these things and creating this new way in which the powers of the planetary system and the stars could be invested here on the earth and reform a corrupted nature. If you read some of John Dee's stuff as an example, Queen Elizabeth I's astronomer and philosopher, you get a lot of this stuff. I mean, this is what was going on in that time period, and over time it gradually, what Dee and what these original spiritualists evolved into was physics. A lot of the chairs that were formed in the 17th century at Oxford and Cambridge and these various universities in Britain, as an example, which were held by alchemists originally, are now held by physicists. Okay, so the whole idea was to translate nature, and that would be God's work. So that is at the core of what was going on in the 19th century. It began to evolve. They began to see Britain was an island nation. Well, they began to look at Russia as a land island surrounded by other lands. And when the Russians began to build railroads and began to explore into these areas and colonize and civilize, in their case, they were breaking down the tribal structure. They were bringing Western forms of civilization to these areas in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, and that those southern, what eventually became the southern republics of the Soviet Union. What they were doing was seen by Britain as a great threat. They saw that what the Russians were capable of doing in this world island, which they considered to be Eurasia, that the Russians were control over, was the same thing that they had done with their naval forces on the oceans of the world from their island. So they really, a kind of philosophical panic set in right at the core of the British ruling structure and their financial structure. Because that is what their trade around the world is what had made them a great power. They were just an impoverished, you know, despite all the propaganda that we get today about the wonders of Elizabethan England and the courts and the castles and the knights and all that stuff. That's Hollywood. The fact is that as of 1600, Britain was a very, very small island nation with very much of a backward culture. That had yet to really explore the world in any meaningful sense, and had to keep up with the Portuguese fleets and the Spanish fleets and the Dutch and a lot of other nations who were already ahead of them in that part of the world.
In fact, that was one of the reasons why the British Empire felt that it really needed to really colonize Afghanistan. You know, when it was dealing with the Indian Empire, its Indian Empire, it was looking at Russia coming down and putting pressure on, on the northern side of Afghanistan. It viewed that as an encroachment on its empire. So you can see the same configuration that certainly went on today between, you know, what was the proxy war with the United States and the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union is really was a replacement for the kind of attitude that the British Empire brought to the region in the 19th century. But when they fought three wars, with the Afghans, they really didn't do very well. They were not able to effectively colonize Afghanistan. And what happened by the end of the 19th century was the fact that out of absolute frustration, an arbitrary line was drawn dividing Afghanistan's Pashtun homelands west from the Hindu Kush to the Indus River. And that separated, that effectively divided in half. There are something like, they claim up to 40 million Pashtuns that live on the western side, on the eastern side. And on the western side, you have something like 20 million Pashtuns that are still in Afghanistan. That's all part of these crisis areas that the Pakistanis are having such a difficult time with. Well, this line was created in 1893 by Mortimer Durand as a solution to the fact that the British could not colonize Afghanistan. And what they did is they simply arbitrarily decided to create a sphere of influence, effectively, and the British would control the eastern side of it and the Afghans would control the western side of it. But it was never an accepted delineation to actually separate Afghanistan from its own homelands, Pashtun homelands.
Now remember that these areas that were that were divided on the British side of the border, this was never set up to be a democratically elected state. The area that became Pakistan in 1947 was set up as a corporation. It was set up by the East India Company and divided up by the East India Company in the 18th and 19th century in order to govern it as agencies. The company would appoint an agent to run that particular tribal area, and that agent would then be the judge and jury for that particular group of people, and he had absolute power and authority over that. So this was all kind of like a corporate manager. He was like the company manager, would come in and manage your district, your town, for the benefit and behalf of the British Empire and for the East India Company.
And that's one of the reasons why today Pakistan really, you know, in some ways has really not matured in terms of its as a state. It has not gone through a lot of the natural growth processes.
Ahmed Rashid has even stated that the intent was to keep those agencies, those places backwards. They were forbidden from political organizing. In 1947, there was a plebiscite where the Pashtuns were supposed to vote as to where they would go, whether they would go back with Afghanistan or whether they would become an independent nation unto themselves inside with autonomy inside Pakistan. And pretty much the British government went around arresting all the Pashtun leaders and closing down the Pashtun newspapers. And the vote, of course, was something like 50.5% voted to stay inside Pakistan. So, but the problem was is that the majority of the Pashtuns had been either locked up or killed or weren't able to participate in the election. So this is what Afghanistan has been protesting since 1893, when this border was implemented upon them. And it is still today the source of the problem that the United States just had to put 17,000 more troops into that area, that specific area, in order to deal with the instability that has been caused by this British decision in 1897 to keep those areas backward.
Most Americans, all they really know about Afghanistan are rugs or maybe hashish in some subcultures. But one of the things that you point out not only is that the area has a long history, but that there are many different ethnic groups whose political and social dynamics have affected what is taking place today. I'd like to sort of move into the events of the Cold War. And you've already illustrated that the United States in many ways sort of picked up the British tab in that part of the world, and what had been a dynamic of the British Empire, namely the myth of the 10-foot-tall Russian, then became almost a religious element of American Cold War ideology. Two of the things that you point out that set the stage for the ongoing tragedy there, one was the ascension of Team B, and in connection with that, the ascension of one Zbigniew Brzezinski. Well, explain how that impinges on the entire situation here.
Well, what you've got is at the end of the Vietnam War in 1975, the defense establishment in the United States, the whole concept of the military-industrial complex, the Cold War, all of it had really spent itself. There were people within the industry itself who warned, Paul Nitze as an example, who's considered to be the founder of the initiator of the Cold War, along with George Kennan. Kennan kind of had second thoughts about the way in which the institution was using his information. He was the famous Mr. X. And so he was fired, and Paul Nitze was brought in order to direct it. Well, Paul Nitze warned in the late 1950s, early 60s about the escalation of Vietnam. He said specifically, he's referred to, by the way, as the Vicar of Foreign Policy. He stated that he thought that the United States would use up its war energy by going to war in Vietnam, that it was a bad idea, that our real enemy were the Russians, and that that's what had to be focused on. And as a result of that, I mean, Nitze had been in there from the very beginning. He'd been in the government in during World War II. A lot of these people, by the way, move from Wall Street back and forth. Okay, you'll discover that Goldman Sachs thing comes in quite often, even with Afghanistan. So to get back to my point is that what happens is that 1975 comes along, the United States vacates Vietnam, the military and industrial complex is in a state of shock. Okay. The whole idea behind the American economy and the American way of making war is high technology. The United States solves problems with B-52s. When our guys overseas get into trouble, what do? They call the Predator drone guys, they call the F-16s, and they come in and they drop a 1,000-pound bomb or a 2,000-pound bomb on a village. That's the way they do it. That's our technology. Well, they're discovering today in Afghanistan that technology, of course, has the limits. You kill people that are supposed to be your friends and they turn on you. Well, that's what happened at the end of 1975. So a group was convened. George Bush got into the White House, of course. We had just had this whole calamity with Richard Nixon. Gerald Ford is the president. George Bush is the CIA director. A group of right-wing conservatives and neoconservatives, same as they are today, go to the president and they basically say, they go to George Bush and they say, we need a special evaluation of what the Soviet Union is doing. We don't think the CIA is doing a very good job. And so for the first time in an unprecedented move, George Bush allowed this group, and this group was called Team B, as opposed to Team A being the standard national intelligence estimate CIA people who did the estimates of what the Soviets were up to. Well, these Team B guys come in with this ideological agenda, which is a right-wing ideological agenda with the intention of ginning up the defense budget, recreating the Cold War once again. And guess what? They discover that the entire CIA's national intelligence estimate is all wrong. All those things that you thought the Soviets weren't going to do, they are going to do. Tanks are going to come rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue any day now. But any one of these days, they're going to roll over one of their borders, and all heck is going to break loose, and that's going to be the end of the world. And it's all because the liberals are too weak on defense, and we have to do something. We have to have this enormous increase in our defense budget. So this is 1976. Well, over the next 3 years, they work on the public relations campaign. They form various groups. There's a number of people who are involved in this, Madison Avenue types, Wall Street types, defense industry people, the biggest corporations. Simultaneously, Jimmy Carter gets elected and picks Zbigniew Brzezinski as his national security advisor. Zbigniew Brzezinski is a longtime Russophobe. He hates Russia. He is a Polish exile. He believes that the Eastern Europe needs to be freed immediately, which it did. But the fact is that his intent was to do it, to use the levers of the United States government and to use Afghanistan in order to make that happen. So what happens is that from the middle of 1978, he wrestles control politically of the Directorate of Operations, which is the business end of the CIA. These are the guys who go into countries and overthrow them. He wrestles that away from Cyrus Vance in the State Department and takes control of covert operations. Well, within the next 18 months, the Soviets are invading Afghanistan. And so when we saw this happening, we said, we were doing our documentary in 1979 called The Arms Race and the Economy, talking to all these people, and we said, wait a minute, this is just too convenient. There's got to be a backstory here. There's something huge current flowing underneath the surface here. So, of course, what we did was we got involved in 1979 with our documentary, Arms Race and the Economy, go to Afghanistan in 1981, go back in 1983, only to essentially confirm our original thesis, was that these guys from Team B had managed to cook up a scenario whereby the Soviets were convinced that the United States was preparing to make a nuclear war on them, that the United States was turning back to the hardliners, and so their hardliners took over. And we over the period of time, we began to come up with all kinds of information. I mean, one of the things that was a big concern was the Shah of Iran back in the 1970s, as you recall. Okay, he was operating as America's client.
Paul, I'd like to jump in here. We are almost out of time on this side. I'd like to just point something out for the benefit of younger listeners, and then we'll continue with this on the other half-hour side of this program. The hatching of Team B and the unholy grail, so to speak, was passed from the Ford White House to the Carter White House and Citizen Brzezinski. But many of the people that younger listeners have seen on the political stage in recent years, such as Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, were part of the Ford White House and were part of this team. And, of course, the George Bush who brought in Team B was the elder George Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named, and the father of the fellow who recently and mercifully just left office. We are speaking with Paul Fitzgerald and Liz Gould, the authors of the very important recent book, Afghanistan's Untold Story, published in softcover by City Lights Books. And we're going to be returning to the narrative of just how we got stuck in this horrible mess and who the people were who helped to see to it that we got stuck there in Side 2. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 678, interview with Paul Fitzgerald and Liz Gould. This has been recorded on July 5th of the year 2009. For Paul and Liz, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.